This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. You see the signs everywhere. Now hiring. Help wanted. Sign-on bonus. It looks like everyone is trying to hire new employees. Except, of course, if you're actually looking for a job, then you see that some of those offers are not for everyone. That's especially true for job hunters who have a criminal record. But according to economist Jeffrey Korzenich, looking at these so-called second-chance hires is good for business. He writes about this in his new book called Untapped Talent: How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. Jeffrey Korzenich is one of the business community's leading voices advocating for second chance hiring. I asked why he thought it was time to tackle this topic.
Well, my day job is helping allocate assets for a major commercial bank that runs investments on behalf of clients. And you can't understand investments without understanding the economy, and you can't understand the economy without understanding the labor force. And so I started doing a deep dive 8 or 9 years ago into why so many people were out of the labor force, ways we'd never seen before, and came to the conclusion that social ills were a major workforce barrier, which means a major economic barrier, and that we were heading towards a major labor shortage in this country. And this was this group, people impacted and sidelined or underemployed because of a criminal record, were among the best opportunities to grow our labor force and grow our prosperity.
And it's interesting, you introduce the book saying, this is not a social justice book, this is a business book. This is just, it's strictly business.
Yeah, no, I keep emphasizing this is business, not charity. Now, obviously, we will do a lot of social good if we can find pathways to employment and really engagement of people who've been so marginalized. But I think it's important to make the business case because our problem is so large, you need the solutions to be scalable. And the solutions for the solutions to be scalable, it means this has to be profitable for businesses to employ people with criminal records. Otherwise, we just can't get there.
You point out also in the book that the labor force should have 2 to 3 million more people in it right now. Where did these people go?
Well, I have to tell you, that was an estimate prior to the pandemic. Mm-hmm. This pandemic has made it all worse, and we're probably looking now at something along the magnitude of 4 or 5 million people easily, and probably more. Where they went is some of them just dropped out of the labor force. And we've seen people, in particular those who suffer from addiction, if they're out of the labor force, have great difficulty getting back in, and they may be relying on government services just to sustain their life. Older workers dropped out, particularly in the pandemic, and are just choosing to retire early. But so many people are simply kind of under the line and almost invisible to employers because they have these tarnishes to their records, you know, or what are perceived as tarnishes, particularly those with criminal records.
And you call it, and it's called second chance hiring. Define that for us. What is second chance hiring?
You know, that's a definition that many people interpret more broadly. I use it specifically to refer to hiring people who have been marginalized from the labor force because they have a criminal record. But it really can encompass the need for people to have a second chance because they've been marginalized for other reasons, long-term unemployment, and a history of addiction, in particular, two major areas. And some employers refer to it in that sense.
And those are the major obstacles to people coming out of incarceration or just the legal system.
Yeah, no, what we do know, you know, just to put some numbers on it, because I am a numbers guy, of people who have been incarcerated, the unemployment rate of those looking for a job is 27%. And in the first year exiting incarceration, it tends to be an unemployment rate of something like 50%. So given that employment is foundational to rehabilitation, it should be no surprise that we have very high rates of recidivism. People don't have a choice, even if they want to have a choice.
In your research, does the crime matter?
You know, it actually matters very little. People who are in the field of working with people exiting prison will tell you that there are two areas where it might matter. One is people who have been charged with crimes of arson, and those who've been charged with sexual crimes may indicate something in their makeup that would lead to higher risk. But even here, I can cite instances of people who have been charged with crimes like that, who aren't necessarily repeat offenders or don't necessarily have a psychological issue that, that would drive repeat offending. So, you know, there are things you want to look at, certainly, as an employer, but employers who've been doing this for time find that they tend to exclude fewer and fewer crimes as automatic exclusions from employment.
Does gender or age come into this at all?
Gender, less so. We've seen in this country that women typically have a higher recidivism rate or some worse employment outcomes. That's usually related to childcare, not to anything else. Harder to hold a job if you have childcare needs. But age is really, really important. One thing that criminologists have long known is that people, the phrase uses, people age out of crime. And the majority of crime, at least first time crime, occurs when people are young, you know, 18 to mid 20s. But when you are older, you just are less likely to reoffend. And so one of the strong considerations employers have learned to use is if a crime is a long time ago, you tend to have good reason to believe this person will not reoffend.
Well, those ages of the younger people, those are prime schooling years. Is there training opportunities available for these people to get back into the system?
You know, that's a really important question. And there have not been enough opportunities. And many people who are in prison, which is not all the people with felony convictions, many people with felonies are never actually imprisoned yet face many of the same obstacles to employment. But in general, at least among those who are incarcerated, you do see lower levels of educational attainment, for example. But as you know, these are ages when people can learn and are often very willing to learn. So most prisons will offer some pathway to, say, getting a GED. But more meaningfully, our college and prison programs, this was led originally by Bard College, it's expanded to hundreds of colleges are now involved. But there's also a very practical vocational training opportunities that are growing, need to grow more, but that are out there. And, you know, things like Michigan has three vocational villages where they give certifications in masonry and carpentry and auto repair and even do the paper study part for being a commercial driver and getting a commercial driver's license. All sorts of things where we have major shortages in the business community can be addressed, at least in part, with training in prisons.
Does the business community have a responsibility to be a part of that, a part of that help, a part of those system programs?
I don't know if there's a responsibility or not, but I sure think there's a necessity. We stopped having enough babies in this country 20 or 30 years ago to sustain our workforce growth that we've traditionally enjoyed. So this workforce shortage has been coming. It's been accelerated by the pandemic as so many baby boomers retired before they expected to. And so the business community, in order to prosper, has to understand that talent acquisition must include people that they have excluded in the past. And if you want the training done right, you better be involved in the training as well as, quite frankly, I think there's a strong case that the business community has to become more involved in criminal justice reform because it is our criminal justice system, as it stands, is so hurting our current and future workforce.
Almost every job now, including really low-level jobs, have the background check. So no matter what went on in a person's past, it's got to be found out. So I imagine just honesty is the best policy when it comes to that, right?
Honesty is absolutely the best policy, but there's a flip side. The employer is best off and not asking the applicant to list any actual offenses and is better off taking the background check and then presenting it to the applicant for commentary if needed. The reason for that is so often some of these charges occurred in a time of chaos in a young person's life. They may not have the records. The records may not be accurate. And too many businesses ask people to self-disclose. And then if it doesn't match up with what the criminal record does, automatically disqualify the candidate. Even if that record is wrong, the business may not know it. So one of the best practices is, yes, you can, if you're not in a ban the box state, you can ask if someone has a criminal record, but don't do more than look at the background check and see if you need further explanation, show that to the candidate if you otherwise want the candidate, and take it from there and truly assess that individual as an individual.
Will businesses, or should businesses, actually lobby governments to say, hey, we need these people trained a bit better while they're in your custody?
I think you're starting to see that already as the labor shortage really takes a bite into corporations' profitability. And as they understand that this labor shortage is not going away, they become more supportive of any kind of training program, even those in prison or workforce development programs for those exiting prison, or just generic workforce development programs, get better support. Some of that support has to come from the government. And some of that means that the business community should make its voice heard in funding some of these programs.
Once you do take on a second chance hire, how important is having a mentor within the company to, you know, just get them back into life?
I think it depends very much on the depth to which the employer is going. If you're hiring someone who may have a criminal record from 20 years ago, who's been gainfully employed and has a stable life for 10 years, that's just another employee. If, on the other hand, you're hiring someone who is young, maybe just out of prison, then you really need to understand the gaps that they have in their background that are preventing them from prospering and thriving as an employee. And mentoring is absolutely critical. You know, often we in the business community forget or take for granted how we learned the basics, how to dress right, how to act responsibly, all these things that that are the basics of being a good employee, how to take constructive criticism. These are things that may be foreign to someone who's raised in a much more chaotic background, and they need that support to thrive.
Does the fact that an employee is taking the initiative to try to get back into society, is that right there a good enough test of character to get them started?
I think that's an important point. If businesses truly understand the journey someone takes to become just a viable applicant, very often it means that that person had to overcome tremendous barriers. You know, you come out of prison, you may get $100 or something along those lines of what's called gate money. You may be reliant on a public transit system that you don't know to get to transitional housing. Your IDs have been lost. You don't know how to write a resume. You might have gone into prison before smartphones were ubiquitous, or the online application process that most businesses rely on today was available. So there's all these things that the person who's actually a viable applicant has probably had to overcome against enormous obstacles. That should be seen as a sign of character and determination.
Still to come, our conversation with economist Jeffrey Korzenek continues with a look at some of the barriers that second chance hires encounter when they go looking for a job. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is economist Jeffrey Korzenek. We're talking about his new book called Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. In the book, he talks about some of the obstacles all job seekers come up against when submitting their resumes to a company.
I always advise businesses that are interested in doing this to start by looking at the barriers they have unwittingly put in the way of broadening their workforce and having a more inclusive workforce. The Wall Street Journal in particular has done a good job of exposing some of the problems where millions of resumes are essentially discarded because they may lack some keywords that have someone has programmed in. And similar issues with too often requiring credentials, a bachelor's degree for a job that doesn't require a degree. All of these things that are built in, but particularly insidious, are some of these screening programs where no human being is actually involved in looking at an application and they're automatically discarded. That might include, for instance, gaps of employment. People who are unemployed for 6 months or more might be discarded automatically. Well, if someone had to serve a prison term, they're almost certainly being discarded just for that reason alone.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about length of time out of the workforce. And we did just have a really big employment disaster with the pandemic. Are people finding these obstacles getting back into the workforce? Say you've been out of work now for 7 months and you're in your 60s and people just aren't going to look at you.
I think so. We don't have hard evidence, but if history is any guide, people who have been long-term unemployed have very big challenges to re-entering the job market. The late economist Alan Krueger did a study where he actually looked at individuals and what happened once they were long-term unemployed. Economists, by the way, define that as 27 weeks, roughly 6 months. And what his work found is that the longer you were unemployed, the harder it was to get back in. If you did get a job, it was unlikely to stick. And if you got a job that you did stick with, it was likely at substantially less pay than the job you left behind originally. And given how many millions of Americans are long-term unemployed today, given the pandemic, I think that's a real challenge.
So who's doing it right now? Who are taking on these second hires around the country?
So it's interesting. The middle market companies, small to medium-sized employers, have really pioneered this. And in my book, for instance, I go through a number of such employers that have anywhere from 150 to a few thousand or maybe 5,000, 6,000 employees. And those are the ones that may not have been perceived in the marketplace as the employer of choice because they're not household names. But these are the ones that are more often invested in their communities because they're not spread out around the globe. And they've, for a longer time, had to work harder to find talent. I always like to cite the example of a manufacturer, a consumer products goods manufacturer in Cincinnati called Nehemiah Manufacturing. 130 of their 180 employees are second chance. This is a for-profit enterprise. And they have done this so well and so profitably that Harvard Business School sent a team there in 2018, did a case study of the company and their practices. And it's now, I understand, required reading for all MBA candidates at Harvard. They're but one example. There are many others. There's a new Second Chance Business Coalition, which are major household name companies, Home Depot, Procter & Gamble, Bank of America, that are all committed, and Kroger, I should add, a very important addition to that, that have committed to doing trials and sharing data about this. So it may have started with smaller companies we haven't heard of, but it's moving to major American corporations.
I guess those major American corporations are the ones mostly using the automated resume readers, and there you go, there's your cycle.
I think that's right. And there's also, you know, these tend to be more political organizations, the larger organizations, and you run into the inability of people in, say, the HR function to take a major risk. You know, I'm going to advocate for someone with a criminal record. They get hired. If it works out, well, that's perceived as just another appropriate hire. If it doesn't work out, it becomes, who the heck hired this person? Who said yes to this? So there's this heads you win, tails you lose kind of dynamic that is harder in large companies where it truly needs leadership from the very top to drive this forward.
Is this something that institutions of higher education, universities, colleges are taking on, specifically, I guess, community colleges?
They are. And there's even community colleges. There's one in Dayton, Ohio, for instance, that has a reentry center that is focusing on students from this background. A lot of colleges are now providing prison education programs. This has been a big growth area. It's going to be a fairly small amount. It's expensive. Again, many people don't have the educational attainment level to be a viable college student, but it's a step forward. But I'm going to add something to this. I think cultural institutions like universities should also be on the forefront of examining their own hiring practices. I know a number of professors out there who had a criminal background and have thrived, and I'm sure are great teachers. They get great reviews for their teaching, but colleges and universities are major employers. Hospitals, you know, learning hospitals are major, university hospitals are major employers, and they should also examine their own hiring practices as well.
Well, I'll bring one more thing into this, and because we spoke about gender or age, I'm sure race has to be an issue in this too, right?
Yes. I mean, there's been a disproportionate percentage of those impacted by the criminal justice system are people of color. I mean, the tragedy of the American justice system is that it has placed these burdens have not fallen equally. And the statistic that's so telling is 1 in 3 Black men in America has a felony conviction. Interestingly, about half of those, a little over half of those, were convicted of a crime of such small risk to public safety, it didn't even require a prison term. Now, it might have been a fine, parole, probation, might have been some time in a county jail, yet they're left with this terrible barrier. So it has not fallen equally. It has fallen certainly disproportionately on the poor and unsophisticated, who may not have had the same legal resources. And so people get ground down by this system in terrible ways.
Can you think off the top of your head of one real success story of a second chance hire?
Oh, gosh, there's been so many. I mean, some of these are kind of, you know, smaller scale, but certainly I've met people. One of the companies that I talk about in my book, I devote a whole chapter to, is JBM Manufacturing, where they have started hiring from halfway houses, from prisons. It was so successful, they set up a training program, a paid stipend training program in a prison. They recycle all the goods that are created there. They don't want to be selling prison-made goods. And I met a young woman from their program. She was already on the way to her promotion. She was doing a highly technical skill that was kind of groundbreaking. Very few women were employed in this particular machine maintenance skill. She was establishing her own apartment, living space, and, you know, truly rehabilitated and entered. And you know, these may seem like minor things to those of us who haven't been excluded from society, but these are tremendous successes. Given the odds against. I have another friend who was first incarcerated at age 13 for a smoke bomb. He went to juvenile hall. He spent a week there because, as he put it, his parents were too drunk to pick him up. And then at age 18, he made a mistake. He stole an MP3 player. He was charged for that with a felony. They told him he was unsophisticated. They told him that he could go to prison for 6 years, but if he pled guilty, he could go for 2 years. He since got out. He's had a gold record. He's in the entertainment industry. He's been an ambassador of sorts for the UN. He's now in the investment business. So these successes are everywhere. We just don't know where to look all the time. This is more than just giving someone a job. You have to go about this with intention. And what I found in my research is that if you don't go about it the right way, you're not going to see success. But if you treat this pool as a talent pool and go looking for who's a good fit and then make sure you give them the tools to thrive, you get not just any employee, you get an exceptionally engaged and loyal employee. That's a recipe for productivity and a recipe for profitability. So done right, it works. If employers who are listening have not seen it work, it's probably because they were pursuing one of the other models and should really give this a second try, but go about it with intention.
Again, the name of Jeffrey Korzenick's new book is Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. It's published by HarperCollins Leadership. Jeffrey Korzenick spoke about the importance of having a mentor for younger employees. Seems like that's also the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Mentors are key for post-collegiate transition. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Alexis Redding, lecturer at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, suggests the types of mentors to seek out.
During the college years, as students begin to explore options for their future, new post-college pathways often emerge. After the experience of broadening their horizons, narrowing these options and making decisions about the future can be especially challenging. In fact, having an expanded network of professional opportunities can actually intensify the anxiety some students experience during the decision-making process. Ensuring that students have the right kinds of mentors in place, not simply a range of people playing this role, can help them make a successful transition to the next chapter. In research on the college experience across generations, conducted with Dr. Nancy Hill at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, we identified three types of mentoring relationships that can better position students to navigate the career search process. These mentors take three forms: mirrors, windows, and guiding lights. First, mirrors facilitate the self-reflection that is necessary to help students see themselves and their interests more clearly, allowing them to match those interests to career paths. This role is often filled by the people who know students best. Second, windows are mentors who show students what is possible. They help them to see the range of options in a given field and to examine the reality of what that work might look like through personal narratives or by providing professional experiences. Third, guiding lights are mentors within the field who provide authentic, firsthand knowledge and authoritative insight into how to both prepare and succeed. These mentors help to illuminate the path and translate emerging goals into an action plan. This model of mentorship accounts for the evolution of students' decision-making processes and scaffolds their changing needs over time.
That was Alexis Redding of Harvard University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.